Okay, hi everyone, and welcome. Welcome to this public event at LSE. My name is Austin Zeiderman. I'm Associate Professor of Geography in the London School of Economics, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome our speaker for this evening, Professor Laura Pulido, to London, but also to the LSE. Laura Pulido is Collins Chair and Professor of Geography and Professor of Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies at the University of Oregon in the United States. And luckily for us, Professor Pulido has recently joined us as Centennial Professor in the Department of Geography and Environment and at LSE's Phelan US Center. A consummate public intellectual and scholar activist, Professor Pulido has been at the forefront of some of the most important developments in human geography and related fields over the past three decades. Her graduate work in geography and urban planning, respectively, and early publications set the agenda for the study of environmental justice and environmental racism, two analytics that are now fundamental to our understanding of spatial and environmental politics, but that were very much in their infancy when Professor Pulido began her academic career in the 1980s and 1990s. And much of the intellectual labor of working out both the methodological and theoretical contours of this burgeoning field of inquiry was thereafter conducted by Professor Pulido herself in a series of foundational, and I should also note, award-winning articles and books, and I'll name just a few of those: Rethinking Environmental Racism, White Privilege and Urban Development in Southern California in the Annals of the Association of American Geographers, also Field-Defining Reviews on Geographies of Race and Ethnicity in Progress in Human Geography, and Reflections on a White Discipline in the Professional Geographer. Her books include Environmentalism and Economic Justice, Two Chicano Struggles in the Southwest, published by the University of Arizona Press in 1996, followed by Black, Brown, Yellow, and Left, Radical Activism in Los Angeles, published by University of California Press in 2006, as well as collaborative projects, such as A People's Guide to Los Angeles, published by University of California Press in 2012, which then kicked off a whole series of people's guides to cities, mainly in the US, but I think elsewhere as well. Going global?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. It's a great series, highly recommended, and hers was central to that. Also, Racial Formation in the 21st Century, University of California Press, published in 2012 as well, and then more recently, editing the unfinished work of the late geographer Clyde Woods in Development Drowned and Reborn, The Blues and Bourbon Restoration in Post-Katrina New Orleans, published by the University of Georgia Press in 2017. And I'm personally ever grateful to Professor Pulido and this body of work for inspiring us to understand the intersecting inequalities that shape environmental and economic processes, especially around geographies of race and racism, but also to appreciate how communities mobilize to challenge these inequalities. And I know many of our students are excited to hear firsthand from somebody whose work they have actively read and discussed. Now, Professor Pulido has recently applied herself to tracking hegemonic forms of racism and nationalism in the United States, or what she and collaborators have termed the political ecologies of the right. And some of this work, which she generously discussed with the Human Geography PhD community yesterday, is about climate denial and white nationalism, focusing on rumors about who and or what is responsible for wildfires in the Western United States. And along with students and colleagues, she's also dedicated herself to cataloging the racist and anti-environmental actions of the Trump administration, no small task, which led to an article, which I highly recommend, and also in the Annals, entitled Environmental Deregulation, Spectacular Racism and White Nationalism in the Trump Era. And tonight she'll be sharing some of her more recent work on cultural memory in the US and how it reckons or doesn't with white supremacy and settler colonization. So now just for a few quick bits of housekeeping, just to advise everyone to put your mobile phones on silent to avoid disrupting the event. And for Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Denial. The event.
I love that, whoever thought of it.
That could be reused for other things. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. And as usual, there will be a chance to ask questions and to engage in discussion with our speaker after her presentation. And the event will be followed, I'm delighted to say, by a reception just right outside, and you're all invited to join us. But now I'm thrilled to hand over to Professor Laura Pulido. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was very generous, and it also makes me feel very old. I have a lot of energy when I talk, so I have to stand up. Thank you. All right, so let's see. So I'd like to begin by thanking LSC for inviting me to be here today, and especially to Kasia and Austin, who first initiated this process of nominating me to be a Centennial Professor. That was very generous and thoughtful of you, and I know it took a lot of work to make that happen, and a lot of work to make this event happen, a lot of many hands. So thank you very much, I appreciate it. I would like to begin today with what we call a land acknowledgement. Now, I'm not sure, are you familiar with this here in the UK? All right, cool. They're very popular in the United States these days. And because much of my talk is about native dispossession and how we deny it, I want to begin by historicizing the land acknowledgement. So here we go. I come to you from Kalapuya Ilihi, also known as Eugene, Oregon. Kalapuya Ilihi was home to the Kalapuya people before the land was taken from them by Euro-American settlers, and they were forcibly relocated to the Oregon coast by white settlers using a range of tactics, including the Oregon Donation Land Claim Act, in which settlers actually took possession of the land without treaties. Today, the Kalapuya are part of the Confederate Tribe of the Grand Ronde and Confederate Tribe of the Siletz Indians. They're active members of the community and remain caretakers of this land. The fact that I begin with a land acknowledgement reflects a particular moment that we are living in. As most of you know, the U.S. racial formation is undergoing profound changes. On the one hand, awareness of white supremacy is widespread. On the other, we're living through the latest chapter of white backlash. This backlash can be seen in numerous ways, including physical attacks against anti-racist activists, the mainstreaming of white nationalism into the Republican Party, and declaring war on critical race theory. As of yesterday, 44 states in the U.S. had introduced over 65 pieces of legislation that curtail what teachers can say about race in the classroom. In this map, the gray pentagons represent states where no such bill has been introduced. These bills vary in their scope, ambiguity, and provisions. For example, some require that teachers tell both sides of racial issues. Others require that no one is made to feel discomfort when discussing the racial past. And still others, such as in North Dakota, prohibit teachers from presenting racism as anything other than individual biases. In other words, there is no such thing as structural racism. These debates about CRT, or critical race theory, are also debates about cultural memory. That is, how we choose to remember the racial past. Never would I have imagined that such ideas would be banned. But that was naivete on my part, because even a cursory look at U.S. history shows a deep investment in white innocence and a desire to preserve it at all costs. In this talk, I explore how U.S. cultural memory represents white supremacy and colonization. So what I'm going to do first is I'm going to provide an overview of the contemporary public discourse around cultural memory. Second, I'll talk more about white supremacy and denial. Third, share my research questions and methodology, and finally present my findings. So let's start with cultural memory. I'm going to define it as popular understandings of the past, which of course is distinct from actual history. While cultural memory has always been important, it has increasingly become a site of public contestation in the US and increasingly what I hear in the UK as well. You have your own struggles going on. Arguably, the current wave of struggle began with Bree Newsom, who climbed the South Carolina State House in 2015 and took down the Confederate flag, for which she was promptly arrested. While this attracted major public attention, others have been quietly working on this topic for years. This image here is from the Equal Justice Initiative. And they've been working for about 20 years, and their goal is to create a marker at every site where a person was lynched in the southeastern United States. And they've made tremendous progress in this work. This other one over here, with the woman with the gun, is Sandra De La Loza, who is an artist in Los Angeles. And as part of a performative art project, what she does is she goes around wherever there's markers of the Mexican-American War, and she puts up her own plaques telling the Mexican side of the story. The city then goes and takes them down, and she puts them back. So they kind of got a little cat and mouse game going on there. These activists and artists know that how we remember the racial past matters. They force us to question who and what we choose to commemorate and why. And what purposes does hegemonic commemoration serve? And how can we disrupt these forms of commemoration? Historic commemoration is a powerful form of ideology. As Stuart Hall reminds us, ideology is a practice. It is generated, produced, and reproduced in specific settings. The current public engagement around cultural memory is unprecedented in the United States. Easily, the top issue centers on who we choose to commemorate. Activists challenge monuments and makers to colonizers and enslavers. As seen in these photos here, this is Robert E. Lee being taken down in New Orleans, and they had to do this in the cover of night because so many people were opposed to it. And then this is from the San Francisco Bay Area, splashing blood on Christopher Columbus. Now, there's many reasons why people oppose such forms of commemoration. Some point out it's offensive to honor such individuals. Others say they make people feel unwelcome. It does not reflect who we are today, they say, or they're painful reminders of the past. Certainly, these are all valid concerns. The Mellon Foundation has recently gotten involved and adopted a two-pronged approach. First, they're investing millions in developing alternative forms of commemoration at the city and local level. Second, they've been analyzing U.S. commemorative practices, specifically who and what we commemorate. This really focuses on the question of what was called just representation. And this is the idea that historic commemoration should reflect the histories, accomplishments, and contributions of the population as a whole, not just those of a few. They conducted an audit of 50,000 monuments, and they had a very broad definition of monuments, as you might imagine, but it really provides a snapshot of who and what we choose to honor. It found, big surprise, that the vast majority of statues were dedicated to elite white men. 75% were landowners, and 50% were slave owners. Among the top 50 people commemorated, there were two black men, Martin Luther King Jr. and Frederick Douglass, two indigenous people, and there's three women, Joan of Arc, Harriet Tubman, and Sacajawea, who I will return to in a moment. There were no Asian or Latino people at all. The audit also found that monuments misrepresent our history. For example, only 1% of Civil War monuments mention slavery. This finding confirms the studies of many geographers who have documented how historic sites in the South, especially plantations, represent slavery. It's this last finding which is of great interest to me. I'm less interested in who is commemorated and much more interested in the collective stories that historic sites tell, particularly in terms of territory. Collectively, these stories create a narrative or series of narratives of the historical geography and territorial development of the United States. I argue that white supremacy and colonization are not only embedded in all historic sites, but that hegemonic commemorative practices routinely erase or deny such processes in order to preserve white innocence. Now, I define white supremacy as a material discursive formation emanating from the idea and practice that white people in Europe are of greater value than people of color and non-European places. Note, I do not say that white people think that they're superior. Well, many certainly do. Far more pervasive is the unspoken but acted upon belief that whites are of greater value. It is because they are of greater value that their needs and desires routinely take precedence over the needs and desires of people of color and non-white places. White supremacy is an ideology rooted in power. It is an enabling logic that facilitates material processes such as colonization, settler colonization, slavery, empire, state formation, and nation building. White supremacy is also a spatial process, one that was fundamental to the creation of the United States. There is simply no way to understand the territorial development of the U.S. outside of white supremacy. It is not possible to believe that countless people willingly gave up their land, liberty, and life so that the U.S. could achieve its current geographical configuration. I'm interested in how we narrate these processes. We can think of the U.S.'s territorial development as a series of regional, racial, and colonial projects in which the nation has created multiple stories to explain how the country came to be. According to Walter Hickson, these stories are more fantasy than truth. He writes, "Fantasy is central to settler colonization. American exceptionalism and manifest destiny are both fantasies that drove U.S. settlement. In attempting to carry out their fantasies, to realize their dreams, settler colonials perceive their actions as the performance of good works." While there's much evidence of fantasy and delusion, the question remains, why? The answer, I believe, is white innocence. According to Josh Inwood, we can define white innocence as the practice of denying the fundamental role racism has played and continues to play in the U.S. settler state. He notes that interrogating white innocence goes beyond documenting the denial. It also requires examining the very categories of white and whiteness themselves as historical processes. Remember, whiteness is not about skin color, but rather a series of power relations and ideologies that we have created. Seen in this way, white innocence is central to the white nation. Drawing on Benedict Anderson and Sunera Thabani, I define the white nation as an imagined sovereign political community in which white people and whiteness are centered. Because whiteness is a hierarchical, genocidal, and exclusionary category, its legitimacy requires the erasure of such violence. This entails the cultivation and maintenance of white innocence. I explore how white supremacy and colonization in U.S. cultural memory function to preserve white innocence through national historic landmarks. Now, national historic landmarks are a particular kind of historic site. Landmark status is given by the National Park Service because a site, quote, represents an outstanding aspect of American history and culture and embodies national significance. To achieve landmark status, an individual or organization must nominate a site and show how the site is truly significant. This is not an easy process. It can take years of hard work and lots of money. It could include, for example, historic or archaeological surveys. But landmark designation opens a door to other forms of preservation support. Currently, there are about 2,600 national landmarks in the United States. This is the place, is in Salt Lake City in the state of Utah. And it is so named because this is when the Mormons were moving westward. They were fleeing religious persecution. And they were looking for a promised land that God had told them. When they reached the edge of the Salt Lake Valley, that's where God said, "This is the place." That is what he told John Smith. And so it's called "This is the Place," and they built this huge monument there to mark where they were given land by God. Now in this project, I asked several questions. First, what forms of white supremacy are inherent in the places and events commemorated by national landmarks? Two, how are various forms of white supremacy represented? Three, collectively, how do they narrate the founding, development, and expansion of the U.S.? And what is the role of white innocence in this process? And I'm just going to be talking about number three today. So to answer these questions, we created a database of all landmarks. And I did not actually create the database, I just oversaw the database. But I had a great team of wonderful students that were working on it. We coded all the landmarks based on the nomination materials, the archival materials. In addition, we conducted selective field work across the United States. Field work consisted, for example, of studying the landscape, exhibits, docents, tours, and the literature and brochures that they had at the various historic sites to see how the racial past is narrated. I identified four different ways in which white supremacy is represented. These are erasure, valorization, multiculturalism, and acknowledgement. And I'll explain each in turn, but it's important to point out that, with the exception of acknowledgement, the other three, erasure, valorization, and multiculturalism, are all forms of denial. Altogether, 92% of all landmarks deny white supremacy and colonization. Let's drill down a bit into the different forms of denial. So as you can, I don't know if you can see this well or not, but 80% fall into the category of erasure. Erasure means complete silence on race and colonization. It is simply never mentioned, not even one sentence. There is no mention of a non-white person. There's no acknowledgement of whose land this once was, of the struggles to make it part of the U.S., of the exclusionary, exploitive, or extractive processes associated with the history of the site and its attendant geography. It is as if the site was part of a non-racial historical geography of the U.S. Instead, the vast majority of sites focus on architecture, 47%. Another 15% are related to the military. Together, they constitute 62% of all sites. In contrast, according to the NPS, only 8% of sites even mention a person of color. What are we to make of such silences? Marita Sturkin has argued that such practices constitute forgetting. But this erasure is on such a grand scale that forgetting doesn't seem to quite capture what is going on here. I think the more appropriate term is denial. Denial on a staggering scale. Stanley Cohen defines denial as assertions that something did not happen, did not exist, is not true, or is not known. People typically engage in denial when the truth is too disturbing or threatening to be accepted. Kari Norgaard argues that denial should be understood as a spectrum. In this case, erasure, valorization, and multiculturalism are all distinct forms of denial. Erasure, as I mentioned, is simply complete avoidance. In contrast, valorization is not just silence, but the glorifying narrative and landscape of denial. Multiculturalism is also a form of denial. Multicultural sites mention people of color, but deny systematic forms of racism and colonization, going back to the idea of just representation. This is where my work is distinct from those advocating for just representation, and I want to talk a moment here about Sacagawea. Now, Sacagawea is a Shoshone woman, and she was a key figure in Lewis and Clark's expedition of westward expansion. And this is an exploration that Thomas Jefferson, as president, had commissioned, and it was to find a waterway access from the Midwest over to the Pacific Coast. And they ended up in Oregon. That was their goal. Sacagawea was a key part of this expedition. She translated, served as a guide, showed them food sources, and literally saved their lives on multiple occasions. Now, most commemorations of Sacagawea celebrate her contributions to building the U.S. nation and territory. She is commemorated because she contributed to U.S. territorial expansion and conquest. Never is the dispossession of her people, the Shoshone, mentioned. We have to ask ourselves, what did Sacagawea think about all what she did? She actually was an enslaved person when she also was part of this expedition. She did not have a choice. She was brought in because she was owned by somebody, a French man. This is a a mural that is painted in a hotel along in Portland, Oregon, which I know some of you will be going to next week. And it's an amazing mural to me. I saw this several times ago when I first moved to Oregon. And it's right across, it's the Oregon Historical Society had it commissioned in a hotel, like right across the street. And it really completely embodies a multicultural narrative. On one side here, we have, on both sides, there's Lewis and Clark on top. And at the bottom, we have Satha Jewia with her son. And over here, there is York. Now, York was also an enslaved person. He was owned by Clark. And he also was brought along on the expedition through no choice of his own. So we have two enslaved people here. So this is kind of, these power or relations, of course, are completely erased in this representation. And they're made like to be in parallel fashion as if they are equal, right? This kind of history in Oregon that we have. There's others of panels of it too, and I really hope y'all go to it and check it out. Now the final category of representation is acknowledgement. These sites acknowledge the racial past in some way, however modest. All it needed was one sentence. They challenge the white nation and its innocence by naming massacres, slavery, and other forms of racial injustice. Only 7.6% of all national landmarks fall into this category. This is a vast landscape of denial. It is not accidental. Creating national landmarks requires deliberate, conscious efforts. As such, national landmarks are a powerful example of hegemonic cultural memory. As I suggested earlier, we engage in such denial in order to preserve white innocence. Currently, white innocence is being questioned in an unprecedented fashion in the US. This has given rise to a tremendous backlash, what Carol Anderson calls white rage. Central to white rage is a denial of the denial, if you will. But the landscape itself is a powerful form of evidence. In the words of Pierce Lewis, landscape is our unwitting autobiography. So let me now share some examples of how white supremacy and colonization are represented. I start with erasure, since that is the most abundant form of denial in the US. This is the Assay Building in Boise, Idaho. There were numerous gold and silver rushes throughout the West in the 19th century. Mining not only created wealth and brought settlers to what is now the Western US, but it also devastated indigenous homelands. And in some places, like in Northern California, resulted in widespread genocide. This building is where the miners brought the rocks, metals, and minerals they had extracted from the earth and converted them into cash. It now houses Idaho's historic preservation program. The plaque on the building reads, quote, "This is the old U.S. Assay office, built in 1870 to 71, and said to have received more than $75 million in gold and silver through its doors." Consider the implications of racial capitalism. The transformation of nature into capital, the taking of indigenous lands for mining and settlement, and not a word about settler colonization. Instead, there's an exhibit about sandstone, which is an abundant material in Idaho and important for building in the area. This is denial as erasure. The next category I consider is valorization. Valorization is a distinct form of denial and epitomized by the Alamo in Texas. The Alamo commemorates a battle in which Texans fought against Mexico to achieve independence. The Alamo is not only about Texas history, of course, but should be seen as an opening salvo in the larger Mexican-American War of 1846 to 48, in which the U.S. acquired half of Mexico's territory. The battle for Texas independence shows one way that settler colonization operates. In this case, U.S. settlers moved to Mexico and became Mexican citizens. They then complained about Mexican laws and restrictions, especially when slavery was banned. And after that, they decided that they needed to be independent. No sooner did they get their independence than they sought to rejoin the white nation. This is not a case of the U.S. state or military taking Mexican land. That happens with the Mexican-American War. But the Alamo is a case of settlers leading the process, of which we have many, many examples of in the United States. As you probably know, the Texans lost the Battle of the Alamo. So how does a site of loss become a site of valorization? First, it does so by erasing the true reasons for the battle. The Alamo has become a shrine devoted to, quote, freedom and liberty. One of the signs reads, "Between February 23rd and March 6, 1836, gallant Texans, greatly outnumbered by General Santa Anna's army, defended the sprawling compound to the death. The Battle of the Alamo stands as a symbol of freedom throughout the world." But of course we have to ask, freedom for who? Since their whole intent was to expand slavery. The Alamo represents an early case of white grievance, which has become so prevalent among the right today, feeling that they are being unjustly treated, right, and they're being victimized by Mexico because they cannot have slaves. The second element of the site, which is important, is that it has somewhat of a split personality. Inside is a sacred shrine. You can't take photos, you cannot talk loud, right? It's all very church-like. The defeat is treated as a sacred and hallowed event. The suffering and loss are vehicles for the purification of the cause and of the defenders, and that's what they're called. This is like a picture of one of the defenders here. They're all around, encircling the Alamo picture, the statues are of the defenders. But on the outside of the Alamo, it's had much more of a celebratory aura. All kinds of things are for sale. You can buy food and drink. This is a really fun place to celebrate Texas history. So it kind of has like a schizophrenic kind of personality to it, the Alamo. The next category I talk about is multiculturalism. Now, to qualify as multicultural, sites simply had to mention a person of color or an indigenous person. This is a very low bar, and still, less than 8% fell into this category. This is Mount Independence in Vermont, which commemorates a battle in the Revolutionary War, or as they called it, they called it the War of Independence. It's located on Lake Champlain, and it was an important battle because British forces were entering from Canada into Vermont territory. Vermont was like Texas at the time. It was its own republic before it joined the United States. A key battle was fought here, which bought U.S. forces critical time in which to mount a powerful counterattack, in which they actually did defeat the British. The site includes a museum, which is supposed to be shaped like a ship, I think, picnic areas, and several trails with exhibits along the way. I even met these two guys along the way. They were very friendly and allowed me to take their picture. Now, indigenous people were mentioned in several exhibits along the way. And this is one of them here. Even before the American army straggled onto Mount Independence in July 1776, people had left their mark on the land here. For thousands of years, Native Americans made tools out of chert, a black, fine-grained stone in numerous outcroppings in the mound, and traces of their industry may still be seen on the ground. Revolutionary War soldiers appear to have discovered and been fascinated by this ancient past. Archaeologists have found projectile points in some of the soldiers' huts. Here we see Native peoples as firmly in the ancient past. Such an historical framing precludes any need to explain displacement and how this land actually came to be part of the United States. I asked a worker about the indigenous people of the area, the Abenaki. Her response was, quote, "Well, there weren't any as far as we know. The Indians passed by this area, but there were no permanent villages here," unquote. This was a common answer I heard throughout the country. There were no Indians in this area. This form of denial is called spatial containment. Indians may have existed in some parts of the US, but not here on this place where we're standing. This statement really is predicated on a particular form of settled memory, which is based on two ideas. First, it ignores the fact that Native peoples used large areas of land in different ways depending on the season. Second, it indicates that the only recognized native presence are permanent settlements legitimized by either archaeologists or found in the English language archive. This is a convenient way of denying displacement. Aside from erasure, this is the most common form of representation. A much rarer form of contestation, one I haven't mentioned, a much rarer form of representation is contestation, all right? Now this is Iolani Palace in Honolulu. And this is a site of erasure that has been actively challenged. This is the palace where the US staged a coup and conquered Hawaii in the 1890s. The queen, who enjoyed widespread support, was forced to abdicate and the US took over. Today, we would call this a false flag operation. The museum itself is mostly devoted to the furniture and architecture of the palace and completely erases any hint of imperialism and conquest. In response, on the 50th anniversary of Hawaiian statehood, a group called Mapuina decided to challenge the dominant narrative. Activists created a performance depicting 4 days in Hawaiian history that tell the story of the coup from the Hawaiian perspective. They tell the story in 6 scenes. Each scene is performed by 1 to 2 people, including some professional actors. The scenes include a Japanese cane worker who was exploited by the American plantation growers, which you can see here, as well as Chinese voters who were disenfranchised by the Americans. Mapuina makes explicit how the Americans literally changed the electorate by requiring English literacy to vote in Hawaii, as well as they explain the bayonet constitution, so named because it was forced upon the Hawaiians upon the threat of violence. This is a wonderful example of speaking back to the white innocence, which is embedded in imperialist expansion. Unfortunately, it is not very common. Let me now move to acknowledgement. I want to share one site from Sitka, Alaska. Now, Alaska was in many ways an anomaly from the rest of the United States. There was widespread multiculturalism and some acknowledgement. This is Castle Hill, where the Russians transferred ownership of Alaska to the US. One of the plaques reads, "In 1867, Russia sold Alaska to the United States. But was Alaska's theirs to sell? The original inhabitants of the land were plunged into a new era with the stroke of a pen," unquote. Now this may not seem like a big deal, but it is dramatically different from the rest of the United States. It is possible that the history of Russian colonization makes it easier to raise these issues, as the US was not the first to colonize the region. In this case, Russian colonization provides a buffer of sorts, which serves to protect some element of US innocence. I want to now analyze shifts in cultural memory. Historic commemoration has changed a great deal over the years. Because most of the sites are older, they embody, of course, earlier ideas of historic commemoration. One place where we have seen shifts is in plantations and missions. And I like to juxtapose these two institutions. Not only are they sites of racial violence and coerced labor, but they were central to settler colonization. And both are treated as romantic tourist attractions today. This is Middleton Plantation in Charleston, South Carolina. Charleston was a leading site in the US slave trade. About 40% of all enslaved persons who entered the US came through Charleston. Prior to the cotton boom in the Deep South, thousands toiled in the rice fields of the Piedmont region. Not only was Charleston the wealthiest city in North America at its peak, but it was pivotal in the defense of slavery and secession. Again, it's important to see slavery as a territorial process. Slavery, like all forms of capitalism, required continual growth and expansion. The South knew that without westward expansion, their economic system would be imperiled. The Middletons had 19 plantations and owned over 3,600 human beings. Middleton Place became a national landmark because of its gardens. They claim it is the oldest landscape garden in the US. It opened as a plantation in the 1960s, but only began discussing slavery after 2000 when, for the first time ever, black descendants showed up at one of the annual reunions. This is called Eliza's House. It is at the heart of the slavery exhibit. It is an attempt to acknowledge the past, but it does so in a very limited way. Middleton acknowledges the past through a labor-centric narrative. Not only are territorial issues never mentioned, but in Middleton's version of slavery, there is no violence, terror, rape, or family separation, despite there being black descendants. Instead, Middleton develops a labor narrative in several ways. First, it acknowledges the humanity of enslaved persons by consistently giving their names and positions culled from the ledgers. All exhibits related to labor feature signs that read something like, "Toby worked at the blacksmith shop." Eliza's House actually lists, and you see this here, all known persons owned by the Middleton family. The second way in which a labor narrative is produced is by acknowledging that the enslaved produced the wealth of South Carolina's planter class. They built the structures, grew the crops, were hired out, and tended children. This is certainly important, and I appreciate the emphasis on who creates the wealth. Making visible such power dynamics should be a key goal of all historic preservation. The third component of the labor narrative is a continual emphasis on the skills and knowledge of enslaved workers, especially in terms of rice cultivation. As Judy Carney pointed out long ago, planters sought enslaved persons from West Africa, Senegambia, and the Gold Coast precisely because of their knowledge of rice culture. And we hear this repeatedly. It wasn't just backbreaking labor, but the skills and knowledge of enslaved persons that created this landscape we see. At one point, a docent at Eliza's House was discussing slave labor and actually used the words economic contributions, to which one visitor replied, "Well, doesn't contribution imply some kind of willingness?" And that's exactly what we never hear about. There is no mention of the coercion, the violence, family separation, and terror. We never hear about the regional postbellum culture of lynchings, the KKK, and Jim Crow. We just hear about the many skills and contributions of enslaved persons. While slavery is represented as an exploitive labor system, which it certainly was, it was not a violent one. In this way, some of the most egregious elements of slavery are denied, and some measure of white innocence is preserved. The final site I discuss is the Santa Barbara Mission in Southern California. Long considered the crown jewel of the mission system, it was founded by the Franciscan Friars in 1876. It is still owned and operated by the Franciscans, and they developed the museum, so this is their take on the past. As I'm sure you know, the Spanish ventured north from Mexico into Alta California and what is now the larger southwestern United States. Spanish colonization was a joint venture of state, church, and private capital. Missions and presidios, or the forts, were key institutions of conquest and colonization. The missions were the province of the church and had several purposes. First, they were intended to convert the indigenous population to Christianity. Second, they were vehicles for Spain's civilizing project. And third, the Indians were intended to be laborers to produce goods and wealth for the missions, the church, and settlements. And according to the Franciscans, the missions were always intended to be temporary. The idea was that they would be give the land back to the indigenous people at some point. Perhaps when they had been sufficiently civilized? I don't know. Needless to say, this never happened. I think it's important to include Spanish and Mexican colonization in this project because they illustrate how white supremacy is more widespread than just among Anglo-Americans. It was central to all European colonization, and even Mexico itself, after independence, actively sought to control and contain nomadic indigenous populations. The Franciscans have put effort into updating the narrative of the mission. This can be seen in greater acknowledgement of the Chumash, who are the regional indigenous people. For example, they have an exhibit showing the lineage of four different native families and testifying that native people are still here today. And that has been, of course, a demand of native peoples, that we are still here. Don't pretend like we're just in the past. So the Franciscans are trying to do that. Well, the majority of the mission focuses on the Franciscans themselves, there are exhibits on Native people and their history. Moreover, there are genuine attempts to grapple with the racial and colonial past. For example, the Franciscans acknowledge the devastating nature of the missions, especially in terms of disease and agriculture. Along with plants and animals, colonists also brought diseases which were not known in this area and from which the local community did not have immunity. These diseases caused epidemics and a tremendous loss of life. Now, the role of disease in mass indigenous death has become an important question. Traditionally, it has been portrayed as an unfortunate but inevitable consequence of an encounter or exchange. But more recent scholarship have challenged this framing, noting that it was inevitable to colonization itself, a very deliberate and orchestrated project of domination. In addition, the Franciscans admit the mission system upended Native subsistence. European-style farming and ranching often resulted in the destruction of the natural habitat, which, before contact, supplied the Chumash with traditional foods and other resources. Even with these admissions, however, the Franciscans never actually take responsibility for Native dispossession, forced relocation, or coerced labor. Despite clear evidence of Native opposition, including a revolt in 1824, but the Nations instead describe themselves as the protectors of indigenous people against Spanish exploitation, which I'm sure they were at times. Consequently, the overall narrative points to an unfortunate series of events, one with limited agency and no accountability. Instead, we get more economic contributions. Oh, wrong one? Yeah. Ultimately, the colonial forces would alter the landscape and set in motion changes that would affect traditional ways of living for the Chumash, but also lay the foundation for the rancho and agricultural economy of California. We can see here clear parallels with the plantation, not only in the focus on economic contributions, but also on the cultivation of such beautiful grounds as tourist attractions on sites of previous racial violence. What does it mean that such sites are major tourist attractions and tell such partial biased stories? What work does this beautiful landscape do in remembering the past? In closing, despite making significant progress in cultural memory, we're still deeply invested in preserving white innocence. We can't yet bring ourselves to tell the full story of U.S. territorial formation, and thus we resort to monumental denial. Our investment in innocence remains entrenched and is a key obstacle to a genuine and meaningful racial reckoning. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Pulido, and I'd like to invite you to come back and join me here on the platform, and then we can open up to questions and discussion with the audience. I will take questions one at a time, and I think there, well, you should probably be able to hear each other, but there is a microphone coming around. So we'll start here in the white sweater.
Thank you very much indeed. Are we okay?
And yeah. can I also just remind everyone to please introduce yourselves, and if you don't mind.
Thank you very much. The name's Ewan Grant. I used to be a UK law enforcement intelligence analyst. I made working visits to the US, though most of my subsequent work's been in the ex-Soviet states. My question is, how different is the reckoning and adjusting? I think you used the final term you used in the sequence of recognizing.
Acknowledgement.
Acknowledgement, yes. Between the areas which were subject to different colonialism, British, French, Spanish. I certainly would say that I really, having been to the Alamo, I really do recognize the absolute veracity of every word you said. I was frankly quite shocked. And almost exactly a year before, I had been equally shocked when I saw, though I didn't realize it at the time, I saw the coming end of the Soviet Union. I was on board a Soviet warship in Greece and completely staggered at the huge ethnic division in the crew. And it was almost exactly a year later I was at the Alamo, but I urge, don't just watch Viva, the film Viva Max. Take close attention to what the lady said. Thank you.
I had not thought about it in terms of thinking about the different European colonizers and the difference. So that's a fantastic question. Does it help? Some of the differences we do see, the biggest difference that immediately stood out to us is that the U.S. is more able to acknowledge slavery than it is able to talk about native dispossession. It is it's just impossible to talk about native dispossession. And when we looked also like at the different, which ethnic groups or native peoples or, you know, the different populations are most likely to be multicultural, it was native people. So native people far and away have multicultural representations, no mention of dispossession. And we are more able, and this is recent, of course, to talk about to slavery. And there's a particular kind of geographies to it also. When we look particularly at like the border between the North and the South, like where slaves would run away, we have a lot of acknowledgement there, right? Because of what was happening. And then in the Deep South, where there has been some actually really important work led by, certainly African Americans and other people on just key plantations to do that. It's still, of course, a minority, but it shows up a lot more. Compared to the West and Manifest Destiny, forget it. We can't talk about it. And other things too, like when you look about the Mexican American War, Spanish colonization, that's a huge form of white supremacy the way we talk about Spain and indigenous people. It's kind of shocking. And I think it's a really interesting, complicated one because like myself, I'm Mexican American, our own complicitness in it as well is really apparent in places like New Mexico, you know? So thank you for that question. I'm really gonna think about that. That's great.
Yeah, open the floor to another question in the back.
Hi, first of all, just thank you so much for the talk. It was really enlightening. My name is Liz Williams. I'm from the US. I grew up in Central Florida. I'm studying urban planning at the master's at the LSE. So the town that I grew up in has a really strong Confederate history and presence still entrenched. And I want to know your reaction or response to legacy organizations like the Daughters of the Confederacy, who've kind of had their mission to be the preservation of white innocence. And I've just been very overwhelmed by how long entrenched they have been, and I would love to hear your thoughts on it.
Thank you for that. So I don't know a lot about Daughters of the Confederacy, but man, Daughters of the American Revolution. we ended up, I didn't know anything. So I should point out, many of these sites, they are initially developed by local communities and like local organizations, like she says, like in the South, Daughters of the Confederacy, Sons of the Pioneers, Daughters of the Golden West, these kinds of things. And so they do that initial groundwork and then they, apply for federal recognition as the sites. And it's mind-boggling to me, and I'm just beginning to study them. We're writing one chapter right now, focused particularly on the Daughters of the American Revolution, thinking about the way, and their motto is education, preservation, patriotism. It's deep. in some ways, the stuff about the, I think a lot more scholarship has been done on Confederacy, Blight's book on, thinking about the glorious cause and the narrative frames that were developed to kind of salvage what had happened. But I find, DAR to be, they go right away at national level, they function, and, they have a very expansive plan, which includes things like Daughters of Confederacy. And it's also very interesting about the role of women, and particularly white women, in doing so much of this work, right? It's pretty deep, and I'm just scratching the surface of that. I have a student working on a dissertation also who is diving deep into a whole series of Midwestern organizations that are doing this work. So I don't know, I'm learning.
Question here in the front, in the gray.
Great. Well, someone's just stolen my question, which was about Daughters of the Revolution, but I'll scramble for another one. I've got two. One is just to get, if you could comment perhaps on Setha Lowe's idea about sort of white denialism, which she uses this phrase niceness, that white people have this sort of aesthetic and discourse about being nice. We might be guilty, but we're nice, right? And she uses this particularly in terms of her work on sort of gated estates and on architectures and aesthetics in particular, which I was thinking about with the Charleston case of the plantation, and thinking about somewhere like the German coast near New Orleans and so forth as well, the sort of succession of plantations, which are incredibly bucolic and wonderful in their setting, and then put the histories of slavery to the back and in smaller spaces. So I don't know if you just comment about niceness as a sort of tool of innocence somehow. And then secondly, and it was partly thinking about sort of the Alamo and stuff, is whether you could comment about the role of universities as sites of denial and innocence. Particularly as somebody who was at UT Austin and had to walk past statues of Confederate generals every day, and then the statue of Martin Luther King, which actually has its back to the Senate, has his back, sorry, to the Senate building,
really?
Whereas the generals all face up, so and have their swords drawn and all this type of stuff. So, but in terms of sort of knowledge production, knowledge denialism, and I suppose the sort of, in terms of critical race theory, then the segue with sort of reparations and what work universities have done historically and what work they might or might not be doing now, in particular through their aesthetics of campus.
There's a lot in there. So I have not read Setha Lowe's work. I got to. I read that book. You know, when I think about like innocence, there's like several like constitutive parts to innocence, and I never think of niceness as being one of them, and that could be because I'm influenced by the Trump era. You know, for the last 8 years, you know, white people have not been nice. You know, it's rage so much that we are experiencing and seeing. So that's not what comes to mind, you know, in, when we think about forms of like white culture and whiteness right now. The big one that does come to mind, and this is like Charles Mills' work, is he talks about the idea of ignorance, white ignorance, as being a central part of white innocence, and the ways in which white people plead ignorance around these kinds of things. And when I go to these places and do the fieldwork, you know, I always go talk to the docents, and it's kind of shocking the stuff they say. I mean, it is just mind-boggling. They truly are ignorant, and which is not their fault, you know, but it's just a reflection of the way we talk about these things, what we learn in school, and the trainings that they go to, because to be a docent, you have to go through some kind of a volunteer docent, even some kind of training process, and it's just remarkable. I've had like docents, like I've heard them tell people about the Mexican-American War. Well, it wasn't like it was really a war, you know. I mean, it was just like, really? It's just, it's amazing that the things that they'll say, you know, or they'll talk about, you know, the Indians. And then as you ask them questions, they like catch themselves realize saying, oh, well, yeah, where did it come from? You know, the land and the Indian people. And then they kind of get stuck, you know. So that's what I see most, more than anything, I think, is ignorance. So universities, so, you know, a number of geographers in the U.S. have done some interesting work around this. You know, at the University of Georgia, they did a really good study thinking about the whiteness of the landscape. At UNC, I know geographers have been on the front lines there of trying to get Silent Sam, a Confederate statue, taken down. And at UT Austin, is his name Gordon? Ted Gordon.
So he has this amazing website looking at UT Austin's history and thinking about it exactly what you're saying, kind of unpacking the racial landscape of the campus itself. So there's a lot of work to be done on campuses themselves. But then one of the most important things also being the whole idea around land back, particularly like land-grant colleges in the United States, which are mostly based on native land. And I know campuses are being forced to deal with that. And then also about native remains. That's been a big one in pressuring them to do returns. Yeah.
Great. We have one question right here in the front center.
Hi, thank you so much for a really interesting talk. My name is Sandesa. I am a PhD student in human geography and urban studies. So I was quite taken by the example that you gave about the performance in Hawaii. Oh. And I was then quite curious about, with the monuments of acknowledgement, whether or not ephemerality and impermanence are qualities that you'd say really characterize them more than the other three types of monuments.
So about the temporality or the...
Yeah, like kind of like the temporality of them. Whether or not they tend to be monuments that are more likely to get taken down, or they tend to be forms of monumentalization that are impermanent, such as through performance art pieces or through performances and, yeah.
Right. So I think in general they do tend to be. And I know a lot of people, or sometimes when I've talked about this, some people say, yeah, but they should be like these, you know, permanent things. And I think there is movement to that. You know, we have like recent things like the Harriet Tubman, national landmark and sites. So, you know, I don't think that there'll be many landmarks moving forward like these. Right. There has been a fundamental shift. So we are going to see that. Now, one of the interesting things, and I was first very critical of this myself, about like the performance pieces, the art pieces, and I'm kind of like a really boring social scientist, but I have really come to see and appreciate the power of art, and I see how art can move people in different kinds of ways. So I tend to now be much more welcoming of it and supportive of it, and seeing it as an important part of the process of reckoning the way that I didn't used to. But also to go back like to the Mellon Foundation, and you know, and they have like, I don't know, like millions that they're giving away for this. It's almost all to artists, and it is to do more, I mean, there probably are some performances and things, but a lot of it is, you know, concrete, very specific things that artists are doing in different places. One of my favorite ones is that there was a Confederate statue somewhere. I don't remember what state it was in, up in the near north of the South. And a group of artists proposed, we're going to take it, and they melted it down, and then they built their own kind of statue, kind of affirming the Black community of that area. And I thought that was just beautiful. I'm not a big fan necessarily also of just taking down all the Confederates and all the racist kind of monument statuaries we have. I think that's actually really important forms of evidence. And I feel they should be disrupted in all kinds of ways. I like the blood on Columbus. I think that's great, you know. But to, you know, so, and I'm kind of an outlier in that position, I know.
Question here in the center.
Hi, my name is Philip Almatowali. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and I study economics. And I must confess, I'm a little bit starstruck. I cited you in my paper that I wrote for my class with Professor Zeigerman and my lovely TA Sandisco. I think that's a really unique opportunity to thank somebody in person for the work of my paper. Thank you for a wonderful talk. And something that I was curious about is whether are your thoughts on the real winners for lack of a better term, in sort of this construction or this reinforcement of the white innocence, which ultimately serves as this sort of hegemonic reinforcement for the nation state, and sort of also within white communities and among white people, what sort of the disproportionate impact has been into buying into these narratives. Because I mean, as we're seeing today with, for example, the opioid epidemic and with the increasing move to globalization, lower class white working people have lost out big under this racial capitalist system. And so I was wondering if you could speak sort of to the true who really benefits out of this, and sort of the role or the disservice that a lot of these monuments and these narratives can do to white people, not just people of color.
So thank you. When I talk about the white nation, it's very important to realize that there are many people that are white people that are not part of the white nation, right? They do not center whiteness and they do not embrace those values. And there are people of color who are part of the white nation, right? We can look at Enrique Tarrio, for example, of the Proud Boys, an Afro-Cubano, you know? So it is not based on one's skin color, but one's, you know, values and beliefs around that. I don't think anybody benefits from it in the long run, you know? To be part of the white nation is to be part of an exclusionary project. It's a project of domination, and nobody benefits from that. You may think you benefit in the short run, and you might benefit in the short run, but that does not serve you well, and it certainly does not serve the United States well. It does not serve the world well to be of that mindset and mentality. It is one based in fear, loathing, and anxiety, right? So much anxiety about changing demographics. What is going to be the state of white people? All these brown people are taking over. They're, you know, taking over the borders. They're changing our history. So it's so much fear and anxiety. And that's a very hard place to live. You know, I can feel empathy with these people who feel that they need to be defending, you know, Confederate monuments and stuff like that, right? The whole idea that that's our heritage, like, really? You know, let's think that through. You know, who exactly does that benefit? So I don't necessarily see this as a project that of capital. I think it is in some ways it is a result. Partly, I don't want to entirely claim it, it's just a result of the growing economic polarization of capitalism in the United States, although that certainly has made people more predisposed, right, and more apt to like go on the defensive to defend this stuff. But, you know, white nationalism, I mean, supremacy, this goes back to the founding, right? And I'm really actually trying to understand Britain and Britain's own racism so I can understand better the racism that comes to, you know, that the settlers bring to the United States. So it's a much larger thing than that, I would say.
Thanks. Right here in the front.
Hi. Excuse me, my voice is not doing so well. My name is Alicia Haishi Lazzarini, and I've been a pink fan of your work for many years. Thank you so much for a wonderful talk. I'm at the University of Exeter, a lecturer there. My research looks at contemporary and colonial investment in Southern Africa, and part of my work is looking at enclaving in the colonial era and contemporary era.
I'm going to come closer so I can hear you.
I look at enclaving a little bit and the production of luxury spaces associated with white settlers, European settlement. And I'm interested in aesthetics, and this goes a little bit back to your question as well. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the role of aesthetics, and particularly beauty and pleasure. I noted, you know, you have a couple of gardens there, sort of pleasure grounds, and in what ways, I wonder, do these sort of aesthetics of beauty contribute to an argument that even if there is a denial of the violence that created these spaces, perhaps that's even a justification for using that kind of violence for a white supremacist ideal? Does that make sense? For the project of white supremacy, like, look what we could do with the power that we had over the coerced labor that produced this.
You know, I don't even find that level of awareness. I don't at all.
find that. I mean, that would be an interesting, I mean, because there's an argument to be made for that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an argument to be made, you know, I didn't show this photo of the plantation, but I have a beautiful photo of this.
I have a tree that there that's like, you know, I don't know, hundreds of years old, and it is over a rice paddy. And this rice paddy was where people toiled in rice fields on this plantation, and they're preserving this tree. They're holding it up with, you know, all kinds of devices, right? It's this amazing, beautiful thing. And I think there's something to be, it could be unpacked as tree as witness, right, to what has happened. And that could become a path or a way to commemorate and honor the memory of all these people, but it's not, right? So we don't go there. So there's, this project has taken me many places I never thought I'd go. But one of them I gotta go is more in terms of thinking about aesthetics and the beauty and, you know, thinking about how it works. So far from what I'm seeing, it is, it's a form of denial, right? It's making people feel good and certainly in the case of Middleton, it was never intended at all to be about slavery. That's a recent thing, right? So this has existed for decades before, these beautiful grounds and landscapes where you can go and have a wedding, right? And it's a much more recent innovation. So I don't think that's like fully worked out yet, you know? And certainly the missions are a similar thing too, you know? And there's a range of missions, and some are kind of in shambles, and some are actually very beautiful, this being one of the more beautiful ones, the Santa Barbara. So thank you, I have a lot of work to do in that.
My name is Melanie Richter-Montpetit. My disciplinary background is in political science, and I work in the Department of International Relations, and I'm a great fan of your work. So thanks so much for your wonderful talk, and thanks to the LSE for bringing her over to the UK. I was wondering if you could just say a bit more about how denial in the context of settler colonization and indigenous presence functions through multiculturalism rather than through erasure in the context of chattel slavery.
How multiculturalism works in terms of...
How the denial, I mean, that's how I understood you, is that the representation works through frameworks of multiculturalism rather than just some kind of flat-out denial and erasure, right?
Yeah.
And I would love to hear a bit more, and if maybe, you know, you connect this to other kinds of even spatial practices. I'm thinking about the military and naming practices, for instance.
Oh, yeah,
but why multiculturalism rather than just flat-out erasure?
Yeah. So
the multicultural thing, I'm not sure when it really gets going. I remember I've talked to some, like, NPS people, National Park Service, and they said, you know, it's really in the wake of the civil rights movement. They start thinking about it by the 1970s, like, oh, we don't have many places about, you know, non-white people here, and how do we include them? And so they begin thinking about that. And so, and they do it in a couple of different ways, and one of them is to find sites that related to the history of non-white peoples as one way of doing it. And then also then in the more hegemonic sites, well, can we find a story about a non-white person that we could highlight there, right? And so you see both of these things going on. And you still, even in contemporary, sites, we still find multiculturalism, although again, there is more of a shift towards acknowledgement that is happening. And it happens in different kinds of ways. You know, like a big one, like for black people, would be like, they became a politician, they joined the military, and it's all about them being part of the nation, contributing to the nation, right? Versus talking about what that person might have experienced in terms of racism or exclusion or things like that, but their forward contributions to the nation, that's really, really clear that we see that. We see that, and the Native people happen in a couple different ways. So A, as I said, they're kind of like the ancient past, right? We get a lot of places where they talk about like the crafts of Native peoples. So you'll find basket displays, right? That's a big one that we found, a big one. I went to this one in Oregon another place y'all should go, end of the Oregon Trail, which is a national site, and they have this one, they again, it's a recent innovation, and they say, we're going to tell both sides of the Oregon story in parallel fashion. And so you have half of these historical markers, they're all about these pioneers, very active, full of agency, building this land, doing things. And the native people are all, here's the games they played, here's the food they ate, you know, here's the baskets they made. There's even a white person doing a drawing of native people. I mean, it's just like this crazy stuff. Or it's this inability to talk about it. There is one marker they had that said, it's told the story of a woman who was forced to move, right, because of that relocation of Native Oregonians. And they never say who forced her to move or why she moved. She was just crying because she had to move, you know? So it's just, we can't wrap our mind about it. The one other thing I'll say about this is the one group of, like, if you can call it like a, the one population that had the least level of multiculturalism are Asian Americans. They had the highest levels of acknowledgement of any group. They had a very small number of sites, but they themselves were actively involved in all the making of their sites. So they played a leadership role, and so they were able to, you know, create the narration of it, you know. So there are a number of, like, the concentration camps from World War II are, you know, there. And some people think, well, how could you put a positive spin on it? Oh, we're totally capable of doing that. But it's because Japanese Americans were able to, like, take the lead that we didn't have that. Yeah. I find it endlessly fascinating, the multiculturalism. Yeah. Okay, Kasha, and then there.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this just really incredible talk. It's such a pleasure to have you here. I wanted to ask you about the concept of just representation, which you said that you have a slightly different take on, and I'd love to hear you sort of expand on that. And also, I mean, if I got it right, you said just representation, according to, I forgot the scholar, but was the idea that historic commemoration should reflect the contributions of the population as a whole. And when I saw that, I was like, whoa, that suggests, first of all, that there is a population as a whole. Like, there's an imagined community that we could represent in a way that reflects some kind of justice. And also that there could be a, like, politically neutral representation of our history, because it seems to me that there is no politically neutral representation of the United States that is possible. I mean, if, you know, if we want to acknowledge these things that you've said, that would require, like, land back, which means land being taken from someone, right? And the sort of the difference between saying this is not a neutral representation and there is no neutral representation, which would seem to me to be also, you know, I guess what I'm asking is, like, what's your conception of justice, and what would better monuments look like, and then what would the effect of that representation be if it were more just?
Right. So I don't consider just representation just at all. To me, it's a form of multiculturalism. And in some ways, it's kind of a response to the, you know, I very much see it as a reflection of U.S. culture, where we do obsess so much on representation, right? So let's include, you know, a black face here, a brown face there, and there we're done. Right? And, you know, I think in many ways liberals have played into that kind of thing, right? That people think that's good. That's just, right? I think that we should be focusing on acknowledgement, right? If we think about this as a process of reckoning, you know, the big thing for me is, like, the U.S., to go back to somebody's question, about your question about, like, the nation. The U.S. nation is in crisis. One of the reasons it's in crisis is because it cannot come to terms with its past, right? And until it comes to terms with its past, it will be tortured by this past, right? And the only way you get through it is to acknowledge it, grapple with it, struggle work it through, right? Other countries have done it. It's really hard, but it's doable, you know? It can be done. And just representation doesn't really help us get in, move in that direction. So I am not a big fan of the just representation, you know, at all. And more than that, it provides an out also. If we have just representation, or lots of just representation, then we don't even have to begin to deal then with the larger kinds of forms of racial violence that created this country. We have Sacagawea, helping to build the US, you know, that kind of thing.
Hi, my name's Dorsey. I'm from Chicago, and I'm in a local economic development master's here. And I was curious to know who do you think the responsibility should lie on, and kind of, I guess, bringing to terms like these monuments. I mean, like on a national level, I feel like the monuments owned by the state sort of. We're paying our taxes into them, like, and we should be able to have a good story, and the government should be kind of like rewriting that. But for some of the ones that are like owned by these organizations that are kind of private and donor like led, how do you kind of get those to change or reckon when there's not really this accountability from them, like on a tax sort of level or like a government ownership level?
That's a great question. Yeah. Who's responsible? So it's probably about, I would say, most historic landmarks are probably private property. Most of them are. The big ones are not. The big ones are state, like Monticello, you know, they're state owned. And so therefore we are, as a public, able to have a lot more input into what happens in there. We could have that voice. And people have been demanding, you know, and Monticello is actually a good example, right? Because of the whole Sally Hemings story, they had to like suddenly, ooh, how do we change, talk about, you know, the story of Jefferson here, right? So that was a really good example of that. The private ones, you know, shame might be one. And then others like, you know, I can't imagine DAR changing any time in my lifetime. I mean, because they are so invested in the white, I mean, they embody the white nation in such a powerful way. That's their reason for being. And I don't imagine that's going to be changing anytime soon. I mean, we could have a whole series of campaigns against DAR, which I think would be kind of cool, you know, to think about that. There was one I was reading about recent, oh, this was another a public one. Again, we see it again and again with the public ones. You're able to do so much more. There was just, at the AAG is happening right now, the geography conference, and somebody was doing a paper on the Sand Creek Massacre site in Colorado. And they said, like, 20 years ago, they rolled out their first kind of like, all right, this is our acknowledgement kind of thing. And the way, it wasn't really acknowledgement, they were like, three sides to the story. There were the pioneers, the military, and the Indians. And the Native people had such a, you know, pushback against it. It closed down within a year, and then it reopened, like, you know, 15 years later, and actually foregrounding the experience of Native people, right? So you're able to make that kind of push and demand, you know, on it. I don't know what to do with the private ones. I mean, it's mostly going to be a localized thing. That's my guess. I'm working on a project, this book. It's going to become a book, a historical atlas of all of these national historic landmarks. And maybe I'll certainly send a copy to DAR, you know. the truth is also, I don't think that, you know, everybody really either understands the extent to which this operates. In the U.S., we just focus on, oh, there's Confederate statues. Oh, that's so bad. And that's just like, you know, a drop in the bucket, really, in terms of large stories. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in terms of research and popular education and letting people know about this is a problem, you know. But it'll be a long time coming.
So that actually perfectly leads into my question, which is kind of two-faceted, which is, but along the lines of, like, what's next? So kind of on a general scale, like you said, obviously there's this this growth, and there's art, and there's beautiful things happening, and amazing people that are rejecting this these monuments and such. But what what can be done I know you just had a bit of a pessimistic view about things not actually being done. So the one side of the question is what can be done societally, and the other side is like all of us walking out of this room, what can we do? So I'm from Ohio, and I've got plenty of people back there that, you know, if I would try and explain this to, they would just shut down and not, you know, I don't know, I hope that you guys don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm afraid you all do. So what sort of tool, what, I guess my question is like a toolbox of all of us walking out of this room.
Students who are, you know, not necessarily like, you know, totally opposed to my ideas. They've been working with them for a while. But if you actually go to a site of denial and erasure, go in advance. And I actually have a little, because I've had a lot of students go do field work for me, so I have like a little form. And here's the things you look for. And go and do the work and check it out. And then go bring people. And just like, you know, you start a conversation. Gee, what do you think happened here? Because you will immediately find all of this, like, this euphemisms, right? These forms of denial. I mean, they're everywhere. You just have to start looking for them. So, and the landscape is such a wonderful way to do it, because it's like, you know, right, tangible evidence. Look what it says. Look at the statue they have. What does that mean, right? And so I think those are really cool ways. The other thing to do is go volunteer and be a docent. I think that is great. I was telling Kasha, I was at Fort Snelling in Minnesota, and we went on the tours, and I went to like three different tours when I was there as part of our field work. And in one of the tours, or two of the tours, there were these two white gentlemen, and they couldn't even really talk about Native people. They could not talk. They really struggled to talk about, Dred Scott was there, there's a story about that, and they had a really hard time talking about it. And in fact, they went to one of the rooms, and it was the room where Dred Scott and his wife lived for a while, and they tried to make it like a user-friendly thing for people to comment. And people would put these comments like, I didn't come here to see about Black history. I mean, it's just like, it's right there, right? And so it's like, and then we went, okay, so I'm talking too many things. So, I mean, for people to see that is a very powerful thing. Right away, you can begin to see what's going on. And then we went on a third tour with a woman who was just like, oh yeah, let me tell you all what happened here from a Native perspective, right? And she's doing God's work, you know? So anybody can in the U.S., I think, can really go volunteer to be a tour guide and a docent. You might have to go through like a week-long training and program and read about a history, but you can bring your own sensibility to that. And then you can go to any of these places, you know, for the most part, too, and bring people with you. I did that with my mom. You know, because she likes to come with me, right? And we would just like have these conversations. And, you know, she isn't necessarily part of the white nation, but, you know, she also like never really thought critically about stuff. And then she starts seeing these things, and it's just like anybody can do a subversive reading of these things. Yeah.
Should we take one or two more questions, and then we can continue the conversation over some...
Okay. Hi. My name is Lumi. Thank you for coming. I've been eagerly awaiting your talks this whole semester.
You.
But basically, a lot of this aligns with a lot of the questions that have kind of been asked already. But I suppose a lot of the discussion has been focused more on like the global South, not the global South, the South, and like the, you know, the West, and places where it might be more, the denial I feel might be more overt. But how do you think we could navigate it with regard to like, especially with like regard to progressive, liberal, you know, white people who maybe feel as if they are acknowledging, but then kind of to be cautious that the acknowledgement isn't just kind of legitimizing, like further, like benefiting from the settler colonial patterns, if that makes sense? Like just, so for example, like the Museum of Natural History in New York, it has this statue and it's somewhat like guy on a horse, and then on his right is an enslaved person, and on his left is a Native American. And they've recently taken the statue down and then replaced it with a picture inside, and where they like acknowledge what's happening in the photo and like with descriptions. And I think it's a really awesome acknowledgement, but at the same time, I think that the museum itself has a, as an institution, has a lot of problems and benefits itself as an institution from like all of these colonial aftermaths. Yeah. And I think, say, for example, the University of Oxford, the Cecil Rhodes statue, even if they took that statue down or they acknowledge it in some way, kind of their failure to make adjustments in other ways, like how do we avoid acknowledgement just becoming a form of like legitimacy for institutions that want to come across as progressive, even if they're.
Thank you. All right. So I think that we have to think about this moment as a step in a process, right? And it is, it's a cracking open a process, right? Like I say, NPS can never do what it used to do again. That just ain't gonna fly, right? So we're at the beginning of a process, and it's gonna be a very long process. You know, we're going through the topplings, we're like rethinking the kind of monuments, and that's gonna go on for a while. And I'm hopeful that, you know, we kind of like will come to a new place. And then there'll be another kind of deeper interrogation and thinking things through. And I mean, I think like the thing about reparations is a good one, right? That I see this as a first step, reparations as a second step, right? To keep moving in that direction, right? And that's really the work, of course, of activists, you know, to keep pushing and demanding and moving forward. And, you know, I don't tend to be overly optimistic, but but we need to keep doing that, you know, yeah. Because they will try to say, oh, I've done it, you know. I mean, the whole the acknowledgement thing, man. I mean, what is it? I'm almost like poking fun at myself for doing it, right? I'm reproducing that whole kind of, you know, of liberal acknowledgement, right? In a particular way, yeah.
There are more questions. It's up to you, Laura, if you want to continue to take them.
I will. Okay, last one here, Nina. Okay. Go ahead. No, so him, her, and then Nina. Okay.
All right, we'll take those two more, and then we'll continue over reception.
Thank you, first of all. It was really enlightening as well. And I'm Erin Kelly. I'm Master's in Environment Development here, and I'm from Pennsylvania in the U.S. And I'm thinking more so on the next steps as well. How do you find you can delicately toe the line between having these conversations without giving too much weight to people that are so deeply entrenched in this denial process, but especially in the environment that has become so deeply polarized and siloed in the US, and especially like you were saying in the Oregon Trail Museum, you're able to really see where they're slipping through the cracks and these euphemisms keep cropping up, and challenging that and fostering these conversations I feel like is important. And at the same time, there's a very delicate line without giving them too much airtime and too much weight to be acknowledging these norms that are so deeply embedded in people's belief systems. So do you find that there is, in terms of next steps, and specifically in addressing Native American genocide as part of American history, how do you find that there is the best way to really embrace those conversations without giving too much credence to those falsehoods?
So, that's a great question. So in my conversations with like docents and with museum people, most of them, they've truly never really thought about it this way. Somebody has called me once a Borat of tourism. You know, so I go there and I have these conversations, right? And they're not planned per se, but I know if you're there, I'm going to talk to you and see what you think about it. And when you begin talking to them, and like you know, because I know I do my homework before I go there, right? So I know that history of the place and things like that. You can kind of just see it on their face, like they're just like, oh, I just never thought about that. What do I do with that? You know? So they're not those people that are like, no, I'm going to keep. You know, I don't find those people for the most part. The Confederate people, I mean, I'm being a bit facetious, but they represent one kind of polar extreme, right? The people defending Confederate monuments because this is our past. Most people actually professionally involved or volunteering even for the most part, they're more open to hear it because they're actually committed to historic commemoration in a meaningful kind of way, you know, and it may not be my way, but you can have a conversation and you can see the discomfort, and, you know, I don't want to make them feel too uncomfortable, but you can tell they will not be the same because they're thinking about it differently now. The other thing I'm going to say about that I have a student doing, the one I mentioned, doing a dissertation in the Midwest, and what they have found is that right-wing groups in the South that are actually opposed to any form of historic commemoration because they see it as part of a federal land grab. So they are just, they're blocking efforts, and even ones that are like, you know, let's celebrate the pioneers. No, we can't do that. And they're just like mobilizing, they're angry, and they're just trying to really stop. You know, under Ronald Reagan, there was a thing called natural heritage areas. And these were areas to, efforts to create like regions or small districts, particularly in rural areas, to promote economic development through tourism and historic preservation. And they're just like, we want none of it. And I'm just blown away. It's like, this is your chance to preserve your white history, you know? And I don't, and so, and they're trying to spread that. So I don't know how far that's going to go. But that's just like totally interesting. The anti-statism is taking over these other impulses. Yeah. Okay, last one.
Thank you. Professor Polito, thank you so much for such an interesting talk. I think I have more of a broad question regarding how you actually experienced the development of this project, because working on racism, working on denial, it's so emotionally charged. It's polarizing. So how do you navigate that with your team?
Let's see.
Thank you.
It may be emotionally charged, but for me, and this is kind of something we talked about yesterday, by researching it, that helps me cope with it. You know, that it's, yeah. I have been, you know, I started off as a geographer with my master's thesis many, many years ago, decades ago, and it was a very contemporary project. Let me go out and survey farm workers and see what their experiences are with pesticides, right? And ever since that moment, I've been working backwards, because it's like, well, no, I can't understand that until I understand what happened before. And this is my way of going back to try to understand through territorial development and formation the very birth of this thing we call the United States. And that's how I cope, I think. Yeah, that's how I cope, for better or worse. Thank you, everybody. Those were great questions. Yeah. I learned a lot.